Chelsea to beat Hull, yes. Man City to beat Fulham, a resounding yes. Southampton to beat Spurs, no. Brentford and Millwall to cause FA Cup upsets, no and no. 2 out of 5 for our predictions. Hello, listeners, and welcome to another episode of the Squawker Talker Football Podcast. My name is Sam Long. I'm your stand-in host, and I'm going to be taking responsibility for 2 of the incorrect predictions last week. Millwall didn't quite roar against Sheffield United, and Southampton could only draw against Spurs, but they came very close to pulling off a result. Today, I'm joined by Mohamed Butt. How are you doing, Mo?
Yeah, I'm all right. You know, it's been interesting midweek of League Cup action, Carabao Cup action. Yeah, looking forward to it. Premier League, Copa del Rey, it's all right.
And also join us is Will Hall. How are you, Will?
I'm all right. I've got.
You don't sound all right.
I've got a phantom cold, I think. Like, not a full blown cold. I'm not looking for sympathy, by the way. I'm just saying that in case I sound weird at all.
Well, good job, Renan.
Yeah. Nice. But it feels good to not be on the hook for an incorrect prediction, as usual, by virtue of having sat out last week. Although I would say the ambition of the prediction seemed to have declined a little bit with the Manchester City to beat Fulham. And what was the other one we got right?
Hull against Chelsea.
So Chelsea to beat Hull. Yeah. Wow. You guys really pushed the boat out.
Well, we went for two potential shots.
Yeah,
we
got both of them wrong.
Okay. Also, here's Ollie Young Miles. How are you doing?
Yeah, very well. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Good.
Standing up this week. So before we preview some of the games in the Premier League this weekend, we're going to be running the rule over the midweek action, namely the Carabao Cup semi-finals and Liverpool's somewhat inevitable win over West Ham. On Wednesday, we had Man City against Man United. Everyone thought it was going to be a dead second leg before the game, and it sort of proved to be the case. Matic's goal wasn't quite enough to spark it into too much life. So Ole Gunnar Solskjaer became just the 3rd manager to win 2 away matches against Pep Guardiola in his managerial career. But it was all in vain. Mo, I know you're watching this one closely. What did you think?
I mean, that...
Delighted, I tell.
No, it's weird to say because it's the weirdest thing because like United beating City at the Etihad, United beating Pep City at the Etihad is a huge thing. It should be a huge thing. But United weren't really good. Necessarily. They defended very well. Solskjaer got his team selection more or less pretty much spot on. Harry Maguire, except for one absurdly bad pass, which he made up for, you know, in proper the cause of and solution to all our life's problems, Simpsons kind of meme kind of way. apart from that, he was actually very good, led the defence well. Luke Shaw, if there's one position where I could say he actually looks like he might actually be a good fit for, it's left side of a back three. Because he doesn't have to do too much attacking and is defensively covered a bit better as well, so it just kind of suits what he can do, which is not much.
Ouch.
United have... It's one of those games. If United had Marcus Rashford, they genuinely could have won that game. Like, it sounds ridiculous to say because...
They did win the game.
They could have won the tie, I should say. They could have knocked City out. Because look, right, this is the... City was so good, though. In the opening 30 minutes, 25 minutes, whatever it was, if you watch them, you're thinking, this is going to be a massacre. It's going to be a bloodbath. But, I mean, you know, it wasn't. And in part, that's because David De Gea played like David De Gea hasn't played in a while. But mostly it's because Raheem Sterling just is like proper jigsaw puzzle against Man United. Just falls to pieces. It's just 19 games against them now, 0 goals. In the Premier League itself, under Pep Guardiola, so since 16-17, he's played them 7 times in the league. He had 10 shots, 6 on target. 2 of them big chances, no goals. 6 shots on target against Man United, 2 big chances against Man United, and he's not scored a single one, considering he's basically scoring against everyone else. Like, I mean, he's not in the best of form right now, Ollie was saying before we start recording, but he does it to everyone, but he can't seem to do it to Man United. He just completely, maybe it's the Liverpool connection, maybe he's got too much of the, maybe it's the Mohamed Salah, Sadio Mane, although Mohamed Salah now did it. But,
as we previously revealed on this podcast, he was a Manchester United fan growing up.
It just seems like there's something, because he's been so ruthless against everyone else, but it's just like against United, he just seems to panic, because there was that one shot where he got put clean through, awful defending by United, by the way.
That was after that was Lingard's fault, wasn't it? And that's what caused Solskjaer to give him the absolute
Fearful. I mean, Jesse Lingard, I don't want to rail him too much, but he picked the worst possible game to play terribly, given that Bruno Fernandes is about to sign for him. Like, that's your position, guys. But, you know, it wasn't like he couldn't even, like, competition and really step it up. But no, he's just like, here's your red carpet, Bruno, walk in. You know, Sterling's profligacy was huge. City as a whole weren't very good. They weren't very sharp. After that first 25 minutes when, you know, Aguero was rebuffed by De Gea, and that you're thinking they're going to blow him away. Once United resisted that initial surge and they sort of adjusted to City's incredible tactical shape, it was like, okay, we can handle this. You know, United were just sort of like, thinking back to the previous game at the Etihad, which is Solskjaer's first win, they were just like, we can handle what you can do. We know you're going to overplay. We know you're going to pass, and then we're going to keep blocking off the channels. We'll get a bit of luck. Cody will play well. And then we'll just hit you on the break every time and we'll kill you. And if United had someone, Martial is one of these players. He's amazing talent, but you can tell if he's going to play well in a game or not within the first 5 minutes. He doesn't like, he can't like dawdle through a game and then suddenly show up and do something magical. You either know he's on it or he's not on it. And he was not on it last night. You could, you're just watching him, you're like, yeah, he's not going to play well today. And he didn't the whole game. He was awful. Greenwood was isolated. Lingard was somehow even worse than Martial. Those two were just terrible. And so United's attack, counter-attack, was basically non-existent until Dan James came on, and then it was sort of okay. So, that's what I say. If Rashford had been on the field, or if Bruno Fernandes had signed in time, you know, United genuinely could have qualified despite being 3-1 down. They could have done another press.
But then in the first leg, City probably should have been out of sight.
Oh, no, yeah, obviously. Like, I'm not saying it would have been like one of those logical things, but it would have been gone back to what I'm saying about City is there's, right, this season is major, major echoes of Barcelona in 2011-12, Pep's last season there, where the players are sort of getting a bit chafing with him a little bit, but tactically he's on a completely different level to everyone else. He's almost gone so far, so advanced tactically that he's thinking too much about things. So like in 11-12, he played a 3-4-1-2 formation, which is fantastic. Busquets played a dual hybrid centre-back midfield role, Alves on the wing, Iniesta on the wing, but like not in full-back roles. It was really, really clever, really, really good. But it didn't necessarily, they beat Santos 4-0 in the Carabao Cup final, but they beat Bernabeu, they beat Real Madrid. So, but they were missing chances anyway. Yeah, they weren't at their most deadly. Once David Villa went down, you know, it was just, and so last night, reminded me of that, like this really weird 3-4-3-2-2-3 formation, like a midfield box, which I thought was a very clever idea, but ultimately I think the players were almost confused by it a little bit because you'd think those four against, with all due respect, Nemanja Matic and Fred, that should be a mismatch, right? But it wasn't really. Apart from the start, there wasn't really a mismatch. Part of that's because Mahrez and Sterling didn't dominate wide as they should do, so they didn't really make United commit to defending them wide. Sterling, Aguero was sort of all right. It didn't flow. It wasn't as fluid as it should have been. And, you know, in 11-12 against Chelsea, if anyone remembers the Champions League final, Barca played Chelsea. Over the two legs, they had 36 shots, 10 of them were blocked, and they only had two goals to show for it. You know, Messi missed that penalty, obviously, second leg. Chelsea, meanwhile, had 11 shots over the two legs, scored three times and went through. In the semi-final against United, they had 17 shots and only three goals to show for it. And it wasn't just that 17 shots, 17 great shots. And they could have had more as well. And United, meanwhile, had much less. And this is the problem with City, right? It's like everyone's looking at the defence. And yes, the defence has been weak, but part of the reason the defence has been weak is because in certain games, the attack just doesn't break teams down quickly enough. And when you're Man City, when you play that kind of Pep style of football, if your attack isn't functioning as it should, I mean, look, they lost the Wolves game because we went 80 minutes and we couldn't break Wolves down. And then eventually the defence just, you know, there's too many cracks appear. And that was the problem. That happened again.
The 2-2 draw with Spurs earlier in the season is another good example of a game they absolutely dominated.
Yeah, it should have just walked. I mean, that should have been like 5-6-7. No one could have complained, but they only went 2 up. And Spurs got a bit lucky with their goals, and they really hurt. But, you know, that's what happens when you don't put your chances away. Now, I know it sounds ridiculous because obviously City have scored the most goals in the league, but they should have scored more. Mm. And again, their defence is obviously a problem in the sense that, yes, John Stones has regressed. Yes, Fernandinho's had to play there. Yes, Laporte's been injured, and that's all true. But they could almost have gotten away with it if they'd scored more goals. If that makes sense. If their attack had been as deadly as it was in the last few seasons and as consistently deadly, like this is the thing, they've shown up in games and destroyed opponents, right? But then there have been games where they just look really meek And that's the, and like at the end of last season, that was almost kind of happening as well. But they went over the line because their defense was so good. Mm. And
you might also say that they were fortunate with the timing of Nemanja Matic sending off in the 76th minute, because Solskjaer was asked after the game whether he had a plan for like the last 10 minutes if they were still in the game.
I'm guessing he did.
He obviously said yes to that question, as any manager would, because how do you prove him wrong? But it's true that like if all they need to do is score one goal last 10 minutes, we've seen how teams who have dominated the majority of a game, then suddenly the mentality and the complexion of the game shifts such that they just find themselves on the back foot because they have everything to lose and the other team has everything to win.
Yeah, I mean, that was the thing, bringing Mata on. You could see he was planning to bring Mata on, but having to then do it without a defensive midfielder.
And they're perhaps lucky that, that Fred and Pereira convinced Juan Mata to walk away from
that was weird, because on the one hand, I'm thinking, okay, Fred obviously has a lot of confidence in himself, which is a good sign for his future at Man United, that he can say, Mata, no, I'll take this free kick. On the other hand, what the hell are you doing? Yeah, Juan Mata's a great free kick taker.
I heard that Michael Carrick and the coaches were on the touchline screaming at Juan Mata to walk back and take the free kick.
I can imagine so. But I mean, you know, because it's like he's brilliant.
He should have taken ownership of that, though. He's what, 31?
But that's Mata, though. He's so nice.
7 years.
He's so nice.
But then
he's
such a... beyond that as well, surely it's on the coaching staff to decide who is going to be taking it. Because
potentially, but like loads of managers who aren't getting roundly criticised at the moment, like Jurgen Klopp, always preach that it's up to the players to make these decisions on the
pitch. And Solskjaer as well, especially, is one of those guys like, we give them a lesson, we let the players sort it out. We let them sort it out amongst themselves.
The penalty situation.
Yeah, exactly.
Surely that's proof of that you have to take control. If you can't trust the Man United players to decide the best person to take it.
Well, they did, but they didn't make the potentially right decision. And in any case, like, Juan Mata is like not nailed on to score the free kick.
Yeah, he's just done it more frequently than Fred has. I mean, it was a weird situation, because on the one hand, I was just very impressed that Fred had the confidence to send Mata away from that, because it's like, he was obviously like a shell of himself a year ago.
He's a player who should be growing in confidence now after Cesc Fabregas randomly praised him on Twitter, saying that he's played really well in several big games recently.
Cesc Fabregas is correct. Yeah. He'd make a great pundit, because Fred has played very well.
He was good. He's probably Man United's best player against Liverpool, despite my prediction being him to get booked. I absolutely predicted the wrong player to get the yellow card in that one. Yeah. Like, my other option was Nemanja Matic, who did get booked in that Liverpool game.
Yeah. It was really
and got booked
well,
twice in the subsequent game against Man City, or not subsequent game.
You can see how Fred, if you put him next to a really good defensive midfielder, so not McTominay and not Matic, someone who's actually a proper orthodox defensive midfielder, like, well, Wilfred Ndidi or whoever, you know, he would be he would shine incredibly.
Unfortunately for him, his future lies in the holding role of a midfield where potentially Pogba.
Fernandez.
Just bombing forward. So no one's helping him, taking shots from range and giving the ball back to the opposition.
He's going to have his work cut out for him, I can tell you that. There's not many positives for United in this, because they lost the semi-final, but they did. There's progress, but we know United can handle the big teams. This is not almost like what they did last night was impressive, but almost like, so we know they can do it to big teams. They've battled Liverpool brilliantly both times they played them, and no one else has played Liverpool as hard as they've played them twice. Yeah. Well, twice. Once, obviously, you could argue Sheffield United and Wolves. Yeah. Well, yeah, actually, fair. Wolves are great. Anyway, you know, so they're a big game team. United can handle big teams. What we need to see is, can they do it against teams that just sit back and give them nothing? Because we haven't seen that at all. Bruno Fernandes should be a huge help, because he loves to shoot.
Saying he takes a shot every 14 minutes.
Yeah, and unlike Fred, he's actually good at shooting. That's the one thing. Fred likes to shoot as well, but he's not good at it. Matic, okay, occasionally does something great, like he did again. You know, and I'm a big critic of Matic. Fair play to him; he was great actually. Apart from the red card, which was kind of unlucky, because that first one he doesn't touch him. It's not really a yellow card, is it? The second one's definitely yellow, and it's very silly to do that when you're on a yellow, because it's Gundogan. He's not going to tear away from you in pace. Someone will catch him. But
this is Matic, though.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Well, no, he's not. He's going to tear away from Matic in pace. But like, there's people behind Matic that could have stopped him. It was a silly thing to do. But he, you know, he played well last night. Good goal. But you know, he's not the defensive midfielder you want. But I thought the most interesting thing of the game for me, and this is just shows what 100%, was Walker at centre back, because that was. I mean, I know it was technically a back three with Cancelo, but Cancelo basically bombed on. It was a back two for most of the game, right? Those two playing next to each other, Walker and Otamendi. Walker has almost everything to be a great centre back for Man City in a tactical sense. Obviously, we don't know how good of a great centre-back he actually could be in any situation, but for City, for the way they play football, they need someone who has pace, who can step up to press opponents when they try to break out, but also has a recovery pace to get back and chase down opponents. They don't have anyone like that. Laporte is a great centre-back, but has no recovery pace. He's not like... a turtle, but he's not fast. He's like reasonably paced. He's like, what's a reasonably paced animal? He's not a turtle or a hare. He's like a badger. Yeah,
they're pretty nippy actually.
Okay. So then what?
Forget the animal.
I'll be here all day. You know, he is some kind of mid speed animal. You know, and that's fine. But you know, City needs someone that has genuine pace to get him back, because you look at them and they leave massive spaces behind, and that's fine. That's how they attack. But then they need a centre back with recovery pace, or as we saw with Kompany, just absurd timing to know when to get up and make a tackle, which Kompany had no recovery pace.
So you're
either
saying Pep's copying Gareth Southgate?
Yeah, because he said he'd never do.
Well, Southgate did it in a back two. I want to see if Pep has the guts to do it in a back four. Like, actually just have those two as the back two, because that's gutsy. But honestly, I think that's the way City, if they're going to win anything this season, it's going to be with that, because there's the other options. Fernandinho is not... Like, you play him against Real Madrid, I'm sorry, they're going to put Eden Hazard on that side, and Eden Hazard is going to walk past Fernandinho like he's not even there. But it's the Champions League as
that's
well.
A red card waiting. Yeah,
well, exactly. And it's the Champions League, so Fernandinho can't even just spend the whole game fouling him, because he will get sent off. So you need someone. You put Walker against Hazard, that makes a lot more sense. I think the back three, but Walker at centre-back is key for City, because it adds a dose of pace, which is the only thing Laporte's missing from his game, which is why Van Dijk is better than Laporte, because Van Dijk has all the stuff Laporte does, and pace, which just that shouldn't even be legal, really. But there you go. That's Van Dijk for you. And I think Walker at centre-back was the most interesting thing from the game, which is weird to say because it's semi-final and City are back to the third League Cup final in a row, and Man United won at the Etihad, which is great. But I think Walker, because that could be the most game-changing thing for the rest of the season, is City have actually found a way to defend against counter-attacks now. Will it last? Will it help in the Champions League against Real Madrid? We'll see.
Yeah, you get the sense, though, that if he was going to try Walker in a back four, then surely he would have done it by now, because they've had injury problems for months. So Man City are going to be playing Aston Villa in the Carabao Cup final after they book their place at Wembley. They've reached the final of the EFL Cup for a ninth time, level with Manchester United. Only Liverpool have made it to the final of the competition on more occasions. Now, Ollie, you were watching this one. Mm-hmm. What did you make of the game?
It's similar in some ways to the first leg, in that Leicester had a lot of chances, a lot of shots on goal, but just couldn't break Villa down. And Villa took their chances when they came. The second goal was great, actually. The two Egyptians combining, both off the substitutes bench as well. El Mohammedi sort of whipped in an unbelievable
great
ball. And Trezeguet somehow finished it as well. I mean, both of those things you wouldn't expect to happen, and they happened at the same time in injury time to send Villa through to a final. So it's pretty mad, but... Yeah, it was an interesting game. It was a really good game, actually. It was sort of billed beforehand, before the first leg, as the battle of the playmakers looking to catch Gareth Southgate's eye. And I thought it was interesting how it did kind of come down to that in the end. In the first leg, Madison was very much involved. I think he had more passes, more touches than anyone else. But Grealish was sort of the defensive pressure reliever for Villa. He won 7 fouls and got a lot of praise for his performance, even though he didn't do much in an attacking sense. And then in the second leg on Tuesday, he got the assist for Matt Target, which I think was intentional. I'm going to give it to him in that he held the ball up brilliantly to start off with. And then he kind of like flicked the ball from his right foot onto his left foot, so it bobbled up perfectly for Matt Target to steam in and smash it in.
Mm. Proper Ronaldinho to Van Bronckhorst vibes, man.
Yeah, yeah. No one really spoke about it. Like, everyone was just like, oh, it was a great assist. But no one sort of touched on the fact that it was either very fortuitous in the way that he did it, or it was completely intentional, in which case it was brilliant. Mm. Because it did just sit up so perfectly for Target to come in and volley it.
I think Pep Guardiola really wants to sign Jack Grealish, by the way.
Why?
Did you hear his post-match comments? He was asked about his thoughts on Villa, and he said, congratulations to Dean Smith, and then just said his second sentence into the answer was, they have one of the best players in the league, Jack Grealish. I'm a really big fan of his. And he previously said during this season that like Manchester City couldn't afford Jack Grealish because of how good he is.
Mm. Well, you could actually see him playing for anyone in the Premier League, I think.
I think he'll be
tactically, I think he'd fit into most teams.
Especially if Villa get relegated. But yeah, it's just curious that Guardiola's dropping more hints than he would ordinarily.
He needs
about
a Sane replacement, right? So, you know.
This is true, yeah.
Really stick him on the left, although... Oh, yeah, Thiebaud makes more sense for that. But anyway. Yeah.
But, I mean, I was looking at the numbers. Madison had 18 shots over the two legs and didn't score.
Was it Madison who posted the tweet?
Yeah, it was, yeah. So this was handball. One of his shots should have been a penalty, really. It was the one that hit Nakamba, and he tweeted about it afterwards saying, how can a Premier League referee not see this? And to be fair, in the VAR world that we're living in now, you can sort of... see where he's coming from a little bit.
Yeah. But he started his tweet, didn't he, by saying, I don't want to make excuses. And then attached a handy gif to make his excuse.
And it's like starting a sentence with, no offence, but...
It was, I did think, watching it was a bit of a Steven Gerrard tribute act in that he was kind of receiving the ball and trying to be the hero and scoring outrageous goals. He was quite unlucky, to be fair, with a couple of his shots. Oyan Nieland, who I'll move on to in a minute, was sensational. But yeah, in the battle of the playmakers, Grealish came out on top, and maybe another great thing to come from the game was his post-match interview where he got his head ruffled and looked so taken aback that someone would dare touch his hair.
But it was like...
kind of dominated the whole interview.
So the head ruffle happens and he kind of laughs at first then he turns around. It's like he sees who it was. So maybe there's a bit
Yeah, so one of the Villa players does it and he kind of laughs it off. And then I think one of the coaches did it. I think maybe there's some sort of beef there. I don't know, but yeah, that was great.
We don't want to speculate.
So yeah, Grealish came out on top, but the hero of the hour was Oyan Nieland, the Norwegian goalkeeper who Villa have done their very best to never play. He joined them in 2018 from Ingolstadt in the Bundesliga. He started off the season 2018-19 in the Steve Bruce days and was very, very shady. Wasn't very good at all. To the extent that Jed Steer, who signed in 2013 from Norwich and had played one league game until last season, suddenly became the number one.
He was, like, I think, called back from loan or something.
He spent his whole career
and then became
loan.
The hero in their semi-final.
Came back because Nieland couldn't do anything. They've signed three goalkeepers since signing Nieland, which, bear in mind, that was 18 months ago. Mm. But Lovre Kalinic, who was even worse, and then Tom Heaton and then Pepe Reina. So basically, they've tried everything they can to not play this guy. And yet, in both legs, he was outstanding, made six saves in the first leg, five on Tuesday. And they were, like, first leg, he made good saves, but kind of saves you'd expect. Whereas on Tuesday night, they were genuine world-class saves. The one from Tielemans where he tipped it onto the crossbar was incredible, really. He made a couple of good stops from Madison as well in the opening 10 minutes, which, if they go in, then obviously the complexion of the tie is completely different.
You've got to feel a bit sorry for Tom Heaton being injured there, haven't you? For his seasons.
The only reason Nieland played was because Pepe Reina had a calf injury, which we don't know the full extent of yet. They asked him afterwards, Sky Sports asked him, are you going to play in the final at Wembley? And he was like, oh, I hope so, yes. But
I mean, I love that instead of saying, oh, it's up to the coach, he was
He obviously deserves it because he was brilliant. But whether he does or not.
What did Watford do about Gomez last season in the...
They played him.
Played him.
And lost 6-0. So yeah, we'll see. But other than that, I mean, Villa deserve immense credit for going through. They were huge underdogs beforehand. But Leicester really blew it. Like, it was all set up for them to win. They battered Villa at Villa Park in the league 4-1 in December. Yet they just couldn't really get going in either of these two legs. And I think Brendan Rodgers, as good a job as he has done at Leicester, he has to come in for a little bit of, maybe not criticism, but you have to question some of his tactics over the two legs. He played a back three in both games, which I'm just not convinced really works. And thinking about when he used it at Liverpool, it started off okay when he used the back three, and then after a while teams kind of sussed it out and it didn't really work.
Yeah.
It was a similar thing here with, I feel there was a lot of round pegs in square holes. Is that the right one? Yeah, that works.
You can do it either way. That's the beauty of that.
Whatever pegs you want.
Well, a round peg would just go into a square hole. There would be gaps around the outside.
Square peg
wouldn't fit into a round hole. So
yeah. Well, you know what I mean.
Anyway. Yeah.
I was still disappointed we couldn't think of a mid-speed animal.
So yeah, I mean, this was part of the issue at Liverpool when he played a back three when he had Emre Can as a right centre back. He was kind of doing this again with Leicester. So he had Ben Chilwell playing left centre back. In this second leg, yeah, Tielemans playing as a holding midfielder in the first leg. Jose Perez was kind of playing, as like a floating number 10, second striker type thing. The whole system, Harvey Barnes as well, was playing left wing back after two games in which he's absolutely destroyed opponents playing left wing in a 4-2-3-1. So I found it weird that he persisted with his back three to match Villa up. And it also left Ricardo Pereira quite isolated on the right wing against Villa's best side. Matt Target and Grealish link up really well on that left. That's Villa's strongest point. And Pereira was just isolated against the two of them. Obviously, that's where the first goal came from.
Second goal came from there as well.
Winning goal. Trezeguet ghosted in. And the first goal was... the only goal in the first leg was an El Ghazi cross from the left as well. So Villa really exploited that area of the pitch for Leicester. And the thing was, it was just strange watching it. Like, Pereira was basically playing as a right wing. In the first half, Soyuncu was basically playing as a right back in the back three. But in the second half, it was almost as if Tielemans was sort of filling in as a right wing back and Pereira was advanced. Like, it was kind of looked like no one really knew what they were doing. And Villa sussed it out and went through against Rodgers. Yeah. And I think it does raise questions about him. It's the second time in 5 years. Bear in mind that Villa have been pretty terrible for most of this decade. They've managed to beat Brendan Rodgers twice in major semi-finals. Obviously, they beat Liverpool 2-1 in 2015 in the FA Cup. And then again this week against Villa. So,
and he was unbeaten in between, wasn't he?
Yeah, when he was at Celtic.
Still counts.
So yeah, Villa is his bogey team, it looks like.
I think as well, it sort of shows that how much Leicester do rely on Vardy, because if Vardy's playing, then you set your team up to be geared towards Vardy's strengths. And when he's not there, Roger's got a few more questions to answer.
I think one of the things that people haven't really picked up on Vardy is that he's improved his all-round game hugely over the last, since Rodgers came in. But he kind of reverted back to old school Vardy when he came on Tuesday night, in that he didn't touch the ball for 14 minutes. They brought him on as a substitute and he didn't touch the ball in 14 minutes, which, you know, was kind of the problem with Vardy before, was that he was a finisher but would go missing if he wasn't scoring goals. And that was kind of the case again. But, you know, in his defence, Leicester weren't doing enough to really help him. And again, it sort of comes down to their style and their tactics on the night.
Well, hopefully the final isn't a walkover, as many people seem to be predicting that it's going to be already. But steering the discussion back to the Premier League, nothing looks like it's going to knock Liverpool off course. They racked up another win against West Ham and they're now 19 points ahead and are 3-1 with Betball to go the entire season unbeaten. Some people are bemoaning the boring lack of a title race. Will Hall is not among them, I assume.
So certainly it wasn't a win that adds any drama to the title race necessarily. Another comfortable win, which actually makes Liverpool the fastest team to beat all of the 19 sides within a single season in the Premier League's history.
Not a mid-pace
animal. It's also the pace of a fast-paced animal. and it was also one where they didn't have to play particularly well. They didn't technically record a shot on target. Before Diop brings Origi down for the penalty, there was a really good chance that Robertson has, where Fabianski just does enough to close down the angle so that he can't dink the ball over him. But that was about it until they concede that penalty. And all of this, at first glance, serves to fuel a couple of narratives which are concerned with diminishing Liverpool's achievements this season. And a caveat up top, I take this all in good humour.
Why are you looking at me, Will?
This is the role of rival fans. I'm not saying that. I mean, I'm not criticising the role that other fans are playing in taking down Liverpool. I think that's what they're there to do. But Mo's favourite is that Liverpool are lucky. And then secondly, Liverpool are only so dominant because the league's particularly weak this season. And the problem with both is that they can't easily be proven wrong. So any attempt to engage with them verges on being a philosophical discussion, almost
the best kind of discussion.
And actually, if you think Liverpool are lucky, then Diop brings Origi down before I think he's about to score. Really, he's 6 yards out in front of Fabianski. And on the second stance, the quality of the relegationist battle, I think, is much better than it was last season. There's only really one team that's dead and buried, and that's Norwich, and they've beaten the reigning champions. Norwich, Watford and Villa, all teams involved in the relegation scrap, all gave Liverpool quite tough games. Liverpool beat Norwich 4-1, of course, but Norwich won the second half.
Yeah. As that was really early on in the season.
Yeah.
Wasn't
it? First game. And other teams that gave Liverpool tough games this season have been Wolves and Sheffield United, who who are doing very well and making a case that it's actually a bit more stronger than you would have thought. It's just that the teams you would have expected to do really well, like do relatively well, like Manchester United and Spurs, just aren't. And to an extent, Chelsea, having dropped off recently. And also look at City. They only had 56 points. I say only, but they had 56 points by this stage last season. This season, they've got 51. So it's not a huge gap between how the reigning Premier League champions have been performing. Mm. Other couple of things I think we learned from a game that ultimately reverted to type and met the expectations of everyone is that you should try not to win corners against Liverpool. They aren't alone in possessing this devastating ability to counter teams while defending corners. Man City also actively set up to break while defending opposition corners. But since Virgil van Dijk's arrival, they seem to have had the most success from it. And if memory serves, a lot of that comes against Arsenal. I did try and have a look at that. I think Van Dijk is significant because David Moyes said post-match that West Ham's set-piece takers were specifically told to avoid putting the ball near Van Dijk's head.
Easier said than done.
Yeah. But as much as you can read into breaking from set-pieces being a tactical gambit that Klopp and his coaches are stressing in training, Salah's outside of the boot pass to set up Oxlade-Chamberlain was the moment of the game for me.
That was outrageous.
And the pass that he needed to play was obvious because Oxlade-Chamberlain is streaming through the middle. But it actually came at a moment where the attack looked like it was about to break down because Salah and Firmino run into each other. And Liverpool fans are probably forgiven for hoping that Firmino would be the one to come out with possession in that one. And that sort of semi-collision has meant that Salah's got the kind of angle where the only thing he can do is just play that outside of the boot pass, and he played it to perfection.
Mm. Oxlade-Chamberlain as well did really well to
hold off the challenge. Yeah, yeah. He was a movable object. He missed a couple good chances. David Moyes came out to defend him after the game and said he's just a little bit low on confidence. But he did stress that during his period in charge of West Ham previously, it was Lanzini and Arnautovic who were the two players he depended on. He's obviously only got one of those now. But he said that he's desperate to get Lanzini back to the level of his previous stint and made sure to underline the fact that he's a really important player to West Ham, just a bit low on confidence. Overall, though, I think West Ham actually did their job despite getting beaten 2-0 because all they really had to do was avoid the kind of humiliation that might provoke another Burnley incident a la a pitch invasion that you were kind of tiffing.
I don't think it's too far away that the fans are pretty angry.
It's the two-year anniversary, isn't it?
Yeah, because they certainly don't want that ahead of what could be a season-defining game against Brighton that we're going to discuss later. Mm. And there were actually genuine positives in that Fabianski's back again and making important contributions, but also in the fact that it was actually Alisson who made the two most dramatic saves of the game, and that reflects well on a West Ham attack that was set up really to be conservative and contain the opposition. I'm referring to Snodgrass's attempt, and I think Declan Rice had another one.
Declan Rice had a header, didn't he? That sort of looping header.
I don't know if it was Snodgrass or Declan Rice who pulled off the shot that got parried out, and then Alexander
Rice,
Arnold.
Rice.
I think that was Rice, yeah.
Alexander Arnold hit the post.
Yeah.
His own post.
Yeah.
Feeding into the lucky narrative out there.
Yeah, maybe.
I didn't say it.
I just think you could just put that out there, and then what's anyone else going to do with it? Like, how do you prove that one way or the other?
Mm. And they were 2-0 up at the time. So it probably wouldn't have mattered.
No, but that's it, isn't it? There was. I mean, Liverpool and luck, and there was someone, I can't remember who it was now, did a VAR user now got data scientists to make an algorithm about what would the table look like without VAR, and it's like, oh, Liverpool lose X many points, but they were still like 7 points clear or something. So it's like...
Got shared by loads of Man United fans, and then when you look at Man United's position in the table, they dropped down to like ninth.
Yeah, Man United have really benefited from VAR. Look, Liverpool are fantastic. The best team in the country, best team in the world probably right now. So it's... You know, they I'm not gonna get into it. I was waiting for you to say it, and I'm just not gonna say it.
I was looking forward to this.
No, look, you can be great and lucky. All the best sides in the world throughout history have been great and lucky You know, that's how you become a really dominant, brilliant side. You've got a bit of luck on your side and you're also phenomenal anyway. So it happens, and Liverpool are in there right now, and that's why they've not lost a single game in the league all season. Will they lose a game all season? I don't know. I thought they'd lose to Man United. They got lucky. Rashford got injured. There you go.
I think the fact that the result was more or less settled after the second goal gave us a little bit of an insight into like how Klopp... Because after that, Klopp kind of seemed to take the time to just experiment a little bit with his midfield. He brings Fabinho on initially. Oxlade-Chamberlain comes out of midfield and goes takes the left-wing role that Divock Origi had previously occupied. Fabinho looked a little bit shaky, was playing some slack passes. I think ultimately he will be brought back into the holding role. But then the second substitute that he makes... is to bring, I think, Keita on for Alexander-Arnold. And then you've got Henderson dropping back into the right-back role, which is mad that, like, the third favourite, I think, for the PFA Player of the Season award is getting, like, roped back into this right-back role, but here we are. And that was almost like Klopp just testing, what would a midfield without Henderson look like? So
I think it was more the fact that he probably wanted to rest Trent and Milner's injured. So
yeah, definitely. I think there were probably underlying, Henderson primarily practical reasons for the decision.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's also good to see what right
with good effect as well this season. He got that. Did he get an assist against United? No, he came in at the back post from that right wing position, didn't he? He's got a couple.
Yeah,
of assists
the one against Spurs, right the looping. Yeah.
And the thing is, the one thing you will say is the way Trent plays right back at Liverpool, the best sub probably is Henderson.
That's true.
In the squad, because you look at the way Trent is, gets forward, it's passing primarily, it's crosses and passing, and Henderson's great at those things. And you know, obviously Henderson's a better defender than Trent is, positionally, well, midfield anyway, positionally, and then one-on-one. Yeah. I don't know. Trent's more athletic, so you never know, but. You can see the logic behind it, in all honesty. Like,
maybe preparing for life after James Milner when he retires in the year. Like, Henderson's going to be my next stand-in right back.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, it's one of those things, isn't it? You often think, how can you get a backup for a player that's always going to play? Because you need a backup, because what if he gets injured? But at the same time, if you have a backup and they only play that position, they're never going to play. Mm. That was Spurs' big thing with how do we get a backup for Harry Kane? And, you know, so Liverpool's solution, rather intelligently, I would say, is, okay, let's just make someone else our backup right back. They can play somewhere else. And then occasionally they'll show up. So Milner was it. And Henderson now is the guy. I think that makes a lot of sense, honestly. It's made more sense than putting Joe Gomez out there, because Gomez is such a different kind of player to Trent. I mean, as we've spoken on this pod before, when you play Gomez there, you know, in theory, you're getting more defensively solid, but you're not, because you're disrupting your entire attacking.
You're disrupting that centre-back partnership.
Yeah. We saw that too, against
Shrewsbury, that Matip and Lovren aren't exactly... No. They've obviously both just come back to fitness, but they had a torrid time, really, against Shrewsbury in that second half.
Lovren got turned
into Gomez. I saw a tweet that I think Liverpool with Gomez back in the side have conceded like 8 goals in 35 games. So.
I read somewhere, I mean, again, I think it might have been Squawker tweet, it might have been our very own J.K. Mitchell, I think, tweeted that Gomez hasn't lost a Premier League game since like January 2018 or something, or April 2018.
Since Van Dijk came, yeah.
Yeah, like he's been just, I mean, and I've said before, Gomez is magnificent. He's such a special player. Because he has such great athleticism, but such great timing as well. And, you know, he's not the organiser that Van Dijk is, but he's also like 21. So it's like, he's like a mini Van Dijk almost. Like, you watch him, if Van Dijk can mentor him and teach him how to organise and lead a defence, Liverpool could be set in terms of having that defensive leader that they can build around for the next decade.
Yeah.
You know, it's honestly, he's that talented in terms of raw ability that the sky's the limit for him.
Okay, that's the review section done and dusted. So we're going to take a little break before we turn our attentions to Premier League Game Week 25. So the January transfer window is going to slam shut in a few days, and we'll probably see one or two new faces on show this weekend. So we're going to start with Spurs, who've been one of the most active clubs this month. Fernandes coming in, Eriksen going out, and Bergvin coming in from PSV. They host Manchester City. So do we think Mourinho's going to crack the Guardiola code, or is Guardiola just going to finish Mourinho?
I think I can see Spurs getting something. I don't know why. I don't know why, but I can see them getting something. I don't think they'll win, but maybe a draw. City, I just think at the moment, are just so indifferent from game to game. You don't really know what you're going to get. And I think the problem with them is that they've got in the Premier League is that the title is gone, but top four is done for them. They're going to finish in the top four, but they're not going to win the title. So they've got bigger priorities now, winning the Champions League, adding another domestic cup, and just consolidating their place in the top four, really, is their aim for the rest of the season now. So I can see Tottenham maybe getting something. Having said that, City's away form is pretty good. They scored 34 goals away from home in the Premier League this season in 12 games, which is 9 more than Liverpool have managed, 6 more than Leicester. And there's this stat as well. City have scored in each of their last 23 Premier League away games since a 2-0 defeat to Chelsea in December 2018. Only twice in the Premier League's history has any team gone longer, and that's Arsenal and Man United, both in 2002. And I think City will overtake United if they score against Spurs, which, considering Spurs have the joint worst clean sheet record in the league alongside Norwich, you'd probably expect that to happen. On the flip side, though, City have conceded 15 goals away from home as well, and that's despite keeping 4 clean sheets. So they've conceded 15 goals in the 8 games in which they've conceded away from home, which is more than Liverpool, Leicester, Sheffield United and Southampton, which is quite interesting. I can see Spurs scoring. I can see City scoring. I'm interested to see what Guardiola does in terms of his team selection, considering how Wednesday night panned out with Man United. I think he obviously went strong for that game to ensure that City avoided a shock sort of comeback from United. But I think his game plan would have been get to 60 minutes, be a goal or two up, and then take Aguero off, maybe give De Bruyne a rest. But as the game happened, United 1-0 up and City couldn't break them down. He had to leave the big guns on all game. So it'll be interesting to see whether Aguero keeps his place. He's obviously chopped and changed with him and Jesus recently. But I think if Aguero does play, it doesn't bode well for Spurs.
He kills Tottenham, doesn't he?
Yeah, he's got 12 goals in 17 games against Spurs. Only against Chelsea and Newcastle has he scored more against an opponent. He's also got 8 goals in his last 6 matches, 6 of which have come in his last 3 Premier League games, in which he's outperformed his XG by 2.61. So he should have scored 3 goals, and he's got 6.
He missed the penalty, though, at Tottenham Hotspur Stadium last season.
Well, this is another thing. Spurs are winless in their last 6 in the Premier League against City, but they did win the last game between these two at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium in the Champions League, obviously with Son scoring. I just think at the moment that the defences are so poor from both sides that there will be goals. Spurs going forward obviously haven't been great. But then there's this whole thing that this transfer window, I think, has been shown that Spurs are moving away from the Pochettino template and are building again for Mourinho. And if you look at their 6 signings this season, all 6 have been under the age of 23. They're trying to build a very dynamic, powerful,
wants a lot of pace,
fit side, that can counter-attack. You know, if you look at Mourinho's best teams, probably his 3 best teams were Chelsea first spell, Inter and Real Madrid were probably his 3 best teams, most complete teams. And 2 of those were reliant on counter-attacking with wingers in a 4-3-3, Chelsea in 04 with Duff and Robben, and Gudjonsson started as the centre-forward, and then it became Drogba, the powerful hold-up guy who could bring others into play. And it was the same at Real Madrid with Ronaldo and Di Maria on the wings and Benzema.
Even Inter, really, in the big games.
Etto into a winger, didn't
they? Yeah. And in Champions League final, they get against Barcelona, obviously. Then in the Champions League final against Bayern, they played on the break. Their 2 goals were on the break. Yeah. So, yeah, he's a manager that loves counterattacks and loves a big centre forward.
I think that's what Spurs are definitely building towards. In the latter stages of Pochettino, they tried to move towards a possession-based style. And Mourinho's come in and scrap that, play direct.
This
transfer window shows it. I mean, Steven Bergwijn, as we touched upon earlier, I think is a club signing more so than a Mourinho one, but there's no reason why he can't thrive in a Mourinho system, particularly if Spurs move to a 4-3-3. Jedson Fernandez, whether he's ready or not, who knows, but he's a box-to-box midfielder who Mourinho will love. And he's on the lookout for a target man striker as well. Giroud has obviously been linked. Piontek looks like he's going to Hertha Berlin, but he was another one. William Jose as well. So they're trying to put the pieces in place for Mourinho to rebuild. And Bergwijn trained on Wednesday. He's going to have 3 days training before this weekend. I don't think he'll start, but if you've got him and Son on the wings, that's a lot of pace and a lot of directness. And given City's defensive issues that we touched upon earlier, that could be an avenue for Spurs to potentially get some joy on the counter-attack against City. Because I can see City dominating much of the game as they did in August against Spurs in the corresponding game. But I do think Spurs can hurt them on the counter-attack. It's just whether they can keep City's attack at bay enough. But yeah, we'll have to see. I mean, Raheem Sterling's another one with a good record at Spurs. He's got 8 goals, I think, against Spurs.
Yeah.
But he's not scored in 7 games. For City.
So is G1.
Interesting enough,
when I was looking up numbers for Man United, he's missed more big chances against Spurs than anyone else. Really? Missed 6 in his games against Spurs. Mm. See, and that's only since Guardiola took over. So,
I mean, he did tear Spurs apart in that Champions League second leg.
He could destroy Spurs, but I mean, equally, I think it would be interesting to see if maybe the United misses have got to him.
Yeah, maybe.
You never know. Like, and like you said, he's not scored in what, 7? Like you 7. Said. So you know, maybe.
Which is that's his worst run for City since April 2017, I think. So yeah, he's not on great form. But yeah, I could see a draw maybe. Spurs sneaking something.
So a draw is the prediction. Next up, we've got West Ham versus Brighton. Will, you pick that one out?
Yeah. My one to watch is, for the benefit of UK audiences, at 3 p.m. on a Saturday. So you won't be able to watch it. But we were talking off air about why I picked it. because I had to explain myself.
Always a good sign.
And I suggested that it might be the most important game of the weekend because the box office one we gave to Ollie because of his connections with one of the clubs. But ultimately in that game, there's not really going to be a lot of movement in the table pending the result. I don't think Spurs can maybe climb up a couple of places, but Man City aren't going to... Well, they might not even put a dent in Liverpool's 19-point lead. Assuming Liverpool also win their game against Southampton.
Which they will, so... You
know. Yeah, which on the balance of probability, as we've seen this season, is the most likely outcome. And then the first game to kick off the weekend's Leicester-Chelsea. They're next to each other in the table, of course, but neither of them are going to drop down a position if they lose it. Whereas with this game, anything but a draw could change the complexion of the relegation battle. West Ham will drop into the relegation spots if they lose and if Bournemouth avoid defeat to Villa. But they could also climb above Brighton and potentially Aston Villa with a win. And they absolutely do need to win because after playing Brighton, they've got Manchester City away, Liverpool away, Southampton at home and Arsenal away. So I think that takes them up to April and they could be bang in trouble by April if they don't get enough points on the game in those games. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, Brighton are probably the Premier League club mostly myself, are most commonly guilty of underestimating.
You just forget they're there.
But they do have just one win in their last 10 games, which means West Ham are actually marginally better form. And Graham Potter finds himself at the stage of the season, which I think many of us will have seen coming, given that he's a progressive manager working at a club who are expected to be in a relegation battle, where his tactics are being questioned. And he says that people's default position is that the answer is to do whatever the alternative is to how they play. And that it can be, as he says, really damaging if when things get more tough, you start to feel the external pressure and then you start not to be yourself.
Yeah.
It certainly looks like that's what's happening at Brighton. And my actual prediction in this game is a draw with under 2.5 goals because of the reasons I've just given. Both teams are going to be absolutely desperate not to lose. Potentially we might see a bit more onus on West Ham being the home side to come out and actively try and win the game. But I just think a defeat is that much more damaging because it would drive them that much closer to relegation. And there are also several parallels to be drawn between both sides in terms of both form as of detailed and even formation that paint a picture of what could be quite an even game. As I said, both managers are working with a lot of external pressure at the moment, and they're also managers who are flitting between formations game to game, both of them with between like back three systems and formations with a four-man midfield.
I think the reason why they're always going to be on the back foot now, they've been dragged into the relegation battle, is purely because they thought they were above it. Everyone else down there well, they're in the relegation battle, where and at least all on side and pulling in the right direction. Even someone like Norwich or like Watford now, compared to West Ham, so disjointed. The whole club, the fans are so annoyed.
I think one piece of evidence that serves to underline the point you just made is that they released their financial results recently. I think it was like a £30 million loss, and the standout line is that the club cannot afford to be playing Championship football. But it was written, I think, earlier in the season when they were in the Champions League spots. So there was all a lot of encouraging sounds about having a world-class manager, that being Manuel Pellegrini, and like the potential to push for those Champions League spots. And then they've been released. Well, they were like on the verge of like the bottom three. Well,
the thing with West Ham is, I think, just jump in, is their fullbacks are rubbish. And you can't get anywhere that without
Ryan Frederick's is right,
but well, he's always injured.
He's just injury prone.
He's always injured. I mean, yeah, Frederick's is very
a young kid. Yesterday,
he played. Yeah, I can't remember. He made his first team debut, but he played.
Like, I like Zabaleta as a person. I think he's been a legendary figure in the Premier League almost, but he's not good anymore. Well,
he's
old.
Not really playing. Masuaku's not. Masuaku's reliable, but he's electric in terms of his ability.
He's a winger. He's great for dribbling numbers. He's a winger. You put him on wing or as a wing back, maybe.
But he has played. He's played at fullback for some time.
No, right? I know. But it's just you know, you look at one of the big things, the big problems that teams have. One of the big undoings of Man City, you could almost argue, is that your fullbacks have to be good. They can either be good going forward or good at the back. They have to be good at something. Like Man United's fullbacks can't attack. Save their lives, but Shaw and Wan-Bissaka are very good defenders. You find it very hard to get past them. You know, you have to double triple up on them, on Wan-Bissaka particularly, to get past him. You know, Liverpool's fullbacks are the best in the world, like the best duo in the world. Alexander-Arnold's a chance creation machine. Robertson is just a ceaseless engine of motion in a more classic fullback sense. West Ham don't have fullbacks like that, and it's hurting them. Look at Man City.
But you could say the same about West Ham's centre backs. You could say the same about West Ham.
I think they've also got issues up top. Sebastian Haller has sort of shown flashes, but he was the link guy at Frankfurt. Rebic and Jovic both thrived off him, whereas at West Ham, he's the guy expected to score all the goals.
That's what, I mean, I was talking to Ben Green, our writer earlier, West Ham fan, and he was saying to me, that's the key thing. We were talking about, what would you sign if you were West Ham? Who would you sign? What positions would you sign? And I was like, right back. He agreed with that. And I was like, you need a midfielder with better energy. He agreed with that. They were looking for Sander Berge, apparently.
It sounds Suchek.
And that could be a really transformative signing if you could just put him next to Declan Rice. He'd be the goal scoring one of the two, and then Declan Rice can be the one.
But then the other thing he was saying was, you need a striker, a second striker, because... we said Haller works in a two. He doesn't work as a one, and you play him as a one, so occasionally he'll get goals, but mostly he needs someone to link with, someone who's going to be nippy, run around him, run off
him. Their injury problems have got in the way of that a little bit as well. I know that he's played like Lanzini behind him, as we spoke about earlier. Lanzini's back from injury, but he's not the same Lanzini that he saw before.
I don't think Lanzini's more of a creative talent. Yarmolenko is the kind of guy that you'd want off him. Like, he's like that Rebic sort of style, where he's a winger plus a forward, can get in and score goals. Or even Felipe Anderson. Really, you want to put them nearer to Haller, but they need someone that can help Haller score goals.
That's what I mean. Those two players you suggested have been injured,
like Chicharito, maybe.
But it's interesting. Moyes as well, in his first press conference, he said that he wanted young, hungry, players who were going to come in and be progressive.
Also, players with sell-on value.
He's almost had to desert that straight away because of the bad position that they're in. Because I think
Suchek's an example of the type of player he was talking about then. Also, a Champions League player. Incidentally,
Now West Ham have got a fair amount of money. They just need to spend it in a sensible way, because
they've literally been throwing money at it.
But
that's what I meant. They should have been spending it in a sensible way, because if you look at, like you said, Pellegrini's a great coach. Like, you've got Pellegrini, you've got these great attacking talents, Fornals, Felipe Anderson.
He's up and down.
But this is the thing, though. It's like, you've got these attacking talents. Why can't you make the most of them? Partly it's because your midfield is a bit too retrograde. Partly it's because your defence can't hold on to it. And it just destabilises your whole team. Like, it's all well and good signing all these really good attacking midfielders. Oh, look at this guy. Look at this guy. If you don't sign even like a couple of good defenders, then it's almost pointless, because then what, your team is completely top heavy, and then anyone that can get at your defence does. Like, look at Arsenal. Arsenal are a great example of the same thing. Arsenal got a forward line to compete with anyone in the Premier League. Their midfield is okay. It's not bad. It's pretty good. Lucas Torreira is very good. Granit Xhaka is very good on his day. the defence is a joke. And as a result, where are Arsenal in the league? How well are they performing? Even with all of Arteta's great ideas that you can see he's implementing them, they've signed Pablo Mari now, so maybe that will be a big help. But you know, when you spend on a team, you have to spend all across the team. You can't just sign all forwards or all defenders or whatever. You know, and the best.
I don't think that's West Ham's problem though. I think West Ham's problem is that they've been trying to make signings that are going to get them into the top six when they're not at that level.
Yeah,
they've always got aspirations to get into that top six, to get into that top four. They're just a mid-ranking Premier League team.
I agree with you that they've tried to get into top four, but I think they've done it in a silly way. Like you said, they've tried to sign aspirational players, but then aspirational players have to be in defence as well, and they haven't. They've neglected the defence, the full-backs, the centre-backs. I mean, Winston Reid is still on the books there. I mean, I know he's been injured and everything, so you wouldn't want to release him anyway, but... like, who are their centre-backs? You know what I mean? I mean, Ogbonna, you know...
Who was getting linked with Man United not too long ago.
Mourinho was apparently desperate to sign him.
Balbuena.
Did give away the penalty last night, of course.
Yeah.
I think this is an issue for them, though. If you look through their team, there are good players in there, but there's not really any good partnerships. Like, Diop's a very good centre-back, but Balbuena's iffy. Ogbonna is pretty indifferent as well. Fabianski's a great goalie behind them. Midfield, Rice and Noble is much of the same, really. Quite pedestrian.
Noble's also getting on now, isn't he, as well?
Noble's actually been pretty good for them this season, but I mean... you know, those two aren't going to, you know, inspire. They're not a top six midfield pairing, are they? We've spoken about Allaire as well. He hasn't got anyone to work with.
I mean, you just look at Liverpool, right? We're talking about spending money and intelligence. Liverpool's two most expensive players in their team are their goalie and their centre-back. They've spent money all over the team. They have not just, like, invested loads. I mean, they invested a lot in Mohamed Salah, right? And to a degree, relatively, in Sadio Mane, I guess.
Sadio Mane was pretty much the same price, and they signed him the season before.
Yeah, so you know, they've invested in attack, but they also invested in defence because it's... And again, you know,
I'd probably say West Ham got the best goalkeeper outside the top.
Yeah, but he's not just goalkeeper though, is it? If you're letting him be bombarded,
but he's missed half the season.
He's been injured, but if you're letting him get bombarded by shots, everyone went on about how great Shay Given always was. But Newcastle let in loads of goals every year because they didn't buy a defence in front of him, and he was just standing there getting peppered by shots. And if that happens to you, even great goalies, look at De Gea. Even great goalies can suddenly lose a lot of confidence and stop being as dominant and stop impacting things. Like Alisson is great for Liverpool, but he's great because Liverpool have a good defence ahead of him, and he can then just come in and be that extra level. Like, you put Alisson behind West Ham's defence, he'll look about as good as Fabianski, probably. Better than Fabianski, but like, he wouldn't turn West Ham into Liverpool suddenly. They wouldn't be like not conceding
any
goals. I'd
say if Alisson was in goal for West Ham, then he could keep West Ham up.
Yeah, he does have the best save percentage.
But anyway, so we should move on. West Ham are four favourites to be relegated, 13-8 with Betball. But we're going to move on to Leicester against Chelsea, our final game to preview. Leicester obviously came up short in midweek, but are still having a really good season, as we've touched on. Top four looks pretty much sewn up. Chelsea in a bit more of a precarious position, just 6 points ahead of the chasing pack, and seem to be at another crossroads somehow, Mo.
they were supposed to spend 150 million and they've not spent anything. So
the war chest is still locked at Stamford Bridge.
Well, I think it's more the fact that Lampard is very cognizant of the fact that if you go out and sign, let's say, a striker, which they do need someone, what happens to Tammy Abraham? Like, and again, it's the same sort of thing with Harry Kane. They don't want to... Frank Lampard, you can tell, does not want to knock Abraham out of the side. Abraham is his number nine, but you need someone that can either back up Abraham, play with Abraham, or, you know, replace him if he's injured or whatever, right? So then how do you sign someone like that? Because how do you sell someone on coming to Chelsea to be a backup?
Well, they've been linked with Mertens, haven't they? Which I think would actually be really smart.
Exactly, because veteran... very talented, very proven, can play
versatile,
wide. That's what they need. Is you need players that can play up front, but also can play wide if they have to. That was Barcelona's big problem for years. How do you back up Luis Suarez? Because Suarez plays all the time. So you can't, you know, that's the big issue when you have to back up superstars or back up... Abraham's not a superstar, but he is clearly Frank Lampard's choice to be the number nine, right? And they haven't signed a number nine. They haven't signed a left back, even though, I mean, that I don't understand. That makes no sense to me because... their left back options are so paltry. Like, you're either playing Azpilicueta there, which isn't really what you want to be doing. They need someone there. Like, they've got youngsters coming through everywhere else on the pitch. They've got no young left back. Like, not that I'm aware of. I mean, Jake might know someone. Jake knows everyone. But, you know, Ryan Bertrand is right there. I still don't understand how no one signed Ryan Bertrand, by the way. He's really good, really solid. I only played for Chelsea before, but he's really solid. 7 out of 10 guy. Just sign him.
I think if Leicester weren't having this ridiculous season, Chilwell would have been...
yeah,
50, 60 million pound guy for Chelsea, but they just can't get him now.
Yeah,
also Bertrand's 30 now.
Yeah, but I mean, that's what I'm saying. You want someone to come and do give you 2 years of it. You can go sign someone else. But look, Vardy hasn't been the same. As I said, Vardy hasn't been the same since Christmas, right? Hasn't scored a goal since Christmas. That's a big problem for Leicester coming into this game. I think if Vardy was in form, with the way Chelsea are defending, you'd back Leicester to score a goal, score a couple of goals. Maddison is shot crazy right now. A lot of it's going to depend on how they manage Chelsea, because Chelsea, you would imagine, with Jorginho and Kovacic, they're going to dominate the game, right? They're going to dominate possession, try and control the ball, move it out wide, work it to Willian and Hudson-Odoi. Willian and Hudson-Odoi have been pretty wasteful lately. They've not really been anywhere near their usual levels. They're going up against Chilwell and Ricardo, who are two ostensibly very good fullbacks. Ricardo's not had his best moments lately, but you know, Leicester on paper should win this game, right? Because you're looking at their players, they've got a better team than Chelsea, they're more coherent than Chelsea, but Vardy's not in great form. Why doesn't score since Christmas? Who scores the goals if Vardy doesn't? Can you rely on Harvey Barnes to have another grab one? If Rodgers plays another back three, I'm not sure that really works against Chelsea. I think you want a back four against Chelsea. You know, it's hard to say, because at the same time, you look at the two Villa goals, right? They both very... The first one was a brilliant goal, but it came from like moments of defensive lapse, which only happened, you'd imagine, because they were playing a back three. Hamza Choudhury wasn't involved. He's usually a very good defensive anchor for Leicester as well.
Well, I guess the big thing for Leicester this weekend is how they're going to actually have dealt with that Carabao Cup exit, because they were pretty crestfallen at full time. You could tell that the players really wanted it, for all the talk flying around that the League Cup doesn't matter. Yeah. You could tell they really wanted to make
it's
that
final. It's a final, isn't it? I mean, you know, Grealish is on about, like, I've been to Wembley loads of times in the last few years. When was the last time Leicester went to Wembley? Like, you know, they would have loved it. So dealing with that loss is going to be interesting. I imagine they'll do quite well, because Rodgers seems to be a pretty good man manager in general of getting his players motivated and confident to keep going. You know, I mean, and they recovered fairly well from getting slapped around by City and Liverpool back to back. So, and that's without Vardy scoring, by the way. So, you know, I just think I don't want to hate to this, but I think it's going to be a draw.
Yeah.
Clean sweep of draws. But games to watch this weekend, guys.
But I will... No. I'm going to say a big score draw, high scoring draw. I think, what was it? I think over 2.5 goals. That's what I think. I don't know gambling talk, but yeah.
Mine's over 2.5 as well.
Okay, I'm going to go over 3.5. No.
I thought that when we mentioned Maddison being shot happy, that he's going to score, because Kepa cannot save shots from outside the area.
I do think...
He's no Ian Neeland.
Yeah, no, he's not. He's not. And I do think Leicester will score at least one or two just based off Kepa just not being the guy that... he's the most expensive goalie in the world. I mean, and that was always unfair on him, because that was just his release clause, but... He just looks rubbish, doesn't he? He's so weak in his goal. And I do think Leicester will exploit that. But I also think, Chelsea have this ability to just find a way to carve teams open. They've got so much creativity in their midfield. And Tammy he loved it against Arsenal, didn't he? Scoring that goal. I think maybe that's going to unleash him in terms of big game production. I mean, obviously, that's assuming Tammy's fit. Obviously, he might not be. But the thing is, even if he's not, Batshuayi, you know, he's not consistent, but he's proven he can show up with big goals. He did in the Champions League. You know, he can score big goals every now and again for Chelsea.
Scored the goal that won them the Premier League under Conte, I think.
Yeah, exactly. You know, Mishy's a regular producer for the
several years ago.
Yeah, what was that? 2 years, 3 years ago? Leicester, I think I can see Leicester going ahead, like maybe two goals ahead or something, but then like getting a bit complacent, and then the back of their minds thinking back to what they did against Villa, where they threw it away and they gave it up, and then Chelsea coming back in. I mean, the game early in the season between the two was a draw at Stamford Bridge, 1-1, where Chelsea won, I think, 1-0 up, and then Leicester came back to equalise, and it was just sort of stayed that way.
Again, that was really early in the season.
Yeah, really, really early. And I think maybe that sort of thing could happen again, but I think Leicester will take the lead this time. It's at King Power as well. And I think maybe Chelsea can pay them back with just a late resurgence, because Lampard has shown that he can make some very good game-changing subs if he has to. And I think he has a better squad than Leicester in terms of like at least having options on the bench. And I think... is Reece James fit? I think if Reece James is fit, he could be a bit of a wild card.
Him against Harvey Barnes would be a good little match.
That's what I'd like to see that. And it's hard to keep a lid on Jorginho. That's the other thing you have to say as well. Like, as long as they can... If Chelsea can find someone else to put in Ndidi's way, to take Ndidi's focus, like Kovacic or Kante, and get Jorginho free, Jorginho can cut Leicester apart as well.
Okay, so all three thrilling draw predictions will be going into this week's BetBall Accumulator. If you're over 18 and gambling responsibly, please check out the link in the podcast description to download their app. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back on Monday with a special transfer episode.